Hello, and thank you for listening to another episode of The Hellcast. I'm MC2 Jarmolowski, and I will be your host. Today we talk to Naval Aviator and Lieutenant Commander Kevin Goldner about how we all impact the mission aboard the ship. And MC2 Warren talks to a Navy diver about the compression chambers that he found in the hangar bay. I'm excited. This is the first Hellcast that I am hosting, and hopefully it won't be the last. But without any further ado, let's get into it. So I'm here with Lieutenant Commander Goldner, who is a pilot who is flying over Afghanistan in the missions that we have currently. So tell me a little bit about yourself and your history.
All right. So 13 years in the Navy. So commissioned 2008. Grew up in New York. Went to college at RPI. Did the ROTC gig for commissioning. Went through the Naval Aviation Training Pipeline. Came out to Japan actually earlier for a JO tour with the Dam Busters. Went back, did a operational test tour, did a CAG staff tour, touring around the different fleets. We did an around the world cruise. And that was actually my first time in 5th Fleet in this theater. That was my first opportunity. That was in 2018 and 19 when we were passing through 5th Fleet. We stopped in and we supported Operation Freedom Sentinel back then. So we got some exposure to what was going on. It was the middle of the winter, so a lot quieter in Afghanistan at that time. So we got some exposure to that, and then we quickly adjusted to operations in Iraq and Syria. So after that, came out here on a department head tour. I'm with Strike Fighter Squadron 102, Diamondbacks. And when we went on cruise and then end up coming out to 5th Fleet, which is not a standard deployment for CAG 5, CTF 70, Strike Group 5. So it was interesting to see how we pivoted to support those operations. And I'd like to say that I was able to bring some of that experience to the team so that we can be better prepared to conduct the missions we're conducting today. And we have been for the past couple months now.
So I was born in 2000, and that means that when 9/11 happened, I was 1 year old. You're a little older than I am, obviously. So what was your experience back then with 9/11? You grew up in New York.
You know, everyone that can pretty much remember when the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon were struck, where they were. When that happened, I was in my French class, actually, in ninth grade. And everyone kind of paused. Everyone turned the news on in the classroom and briefly watched what was going on. And I got word that, hey, the World Trade Centers were just struck. And my dad, his company, so one of his offices was in the World Trade Center, and luckily he was not scheduled to be there at that day. But hit super close to home, people we knew, obviously colleagues of my dad were involved. We were, and I got a lot of extended family that lives in New York City and Long Island and that area down there. So, and obviously knew people that were directly affected a lot more than we were. You know, 20 years at war. Now we find ourselves at the current operations that are happening today.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's always been there for me. So to know that our current goal is to get out of the country and basically to end this conflict for us is definitely a perspective that I haven't really thought about. But that being said, you're currently helping out with that goal. Why are those missions that we're conducting right now, like, why are they important?
Well, thank you for giving me the credit, but honestly, the credit goes towards every member of the strike group, every member of the ship, air wing that's out here. So, yeah, I'm the one in the jet at the far end, but quite honestly, the benefits of having a naval force and a carrier strike group like we do is we can position it where best fits operational need. So, obviously, the fact that we've relocated from a traditional 7th Fleet deployment to 5th Fleet and are able to posture strike power or, you know, overwatch power or sensors, whatever assets the strike group brings, that's extremely unique, especially globally. So the importance of that, keeping ego aside, everyone, you know, wants to take a little bit of pride in a lot of the training they've put in and a lot of the professionalism and dedication they've done to enhance their skills to be able to respond in the support of national interests. So, of course, it's extremely humbling and, you know, there is some pride involved in being able to use the skills that you've learned throughout your career training or bringing previous experiences to help the team get on a successful mindset or successful operations.
I think that sometimes a lot of people on the ship don't necessarily think that their role that they have is very important. But when you look at everything as a whole, what everyone does together really is what drives everything forward.
If you've walked around the ship, you realize there's a giant airport on top, but it can't run, obviously, without every other asset that the ship provides. So I would like to think we design these aircraft carriers efficiently, or at least as efficiently as possible. But everything on here is on here for a reason, and that is to support the capabilities that we can provide in combat, in disaster relief. But obviously, these things are tailored towards combat. So if we are generating combat power, it's due to every single individual that's involved on the ship, whether that be, hey, working down in the reactors, cooking food for the 5,000-ish people that are on board. May not be the glorious, but hey, laundries needs to be done. Things need to be cleaned. Preventative maintenance needs to be done. And we need to be prepared to do that in all cases. So luckily, we're not experiencing combat damage to the ship, but everything from a GQ drill to having DC and repaired lockers manned, all this stuff provides us a level of security or redundancy or capability to allow us to generate combat power. I mean, you could be directly influencing the mission that's going out by providing an intelligence brief, or you could be relieving somebody else's need to do that by focusing on a different AOR that we are postured and prepared to move. Obviously, discussing the unique abilities of a strike group to just move globally, even if you're not focused on what's happening here in Fifth Fleet or in Afghanistan, and you're focused on something else, that still is contributing to the team. Obviously, supply hits, driving the ship, I mean, everything. Moving water, moving oil, moving fuel, moving jets, moving ordnance, whatever it is. And if you need to just take a look at your own job, and maybe it seems small when you compare it to the whole effort, or maybe it's not exactly what you intended on that job being or what you signed up to do. I know if I could walk around the ship and thank each individual and even just get a better look at what they do, it would be awesome if everyone could realize the importance that they are providing towards the team and take that with some pride and some seriousness, because it's awesome.
It's definitely a team sport. Each individual person, all of their hard work, it definitely goes into everything as a whole. If that doesn't get done, then that's a gap that could potentially have the ability to hinder something in the future.
All right.
But thank you very much again for joining me and talking a little bit about what's going on and how important that everyone's role is in our current mission.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So I had a great time talking to Lieutenant Commander Goldner and putting things into perspective about how important every single person is on the ship. But now let's go over to MC2 Warren, who found some compression chambers in the hangar bay. And he was curious about what they were and what they were used for. And I am too, so I'm excited to hear what he has to say.
So on the hangar bay, it's, I believe, hangar bay 1, close to that area, port side. The Navy divers, in sort of what looks like a trailer, a white trailer, have a decompression chamber. Now, they're Navy divers. I thought the purpose of this thing was to keep them sort of acclimated and fit and ready to dive, because you have to go down and there's a lot more pressure. Maybe your lungs aren't used to diving when you're not going underwater frequently on deployment. That's what I thought that was for the divers, right?
Well, yeah. Hopefully you don't go underwater on deployment.
Right. So I figured since they're on the ship, they have to be ready to dive, and that's why they have the chamber there. That's not why the decompression chamber is there.
So it's not for the divers, but the divers have it. What's it for?
Well, they do use it, obviously, when they're doing diving operations and they need it. But primarily, okay, the reason they're here is to be able to operate the chamber for pilots.
For the pilots?
Yes, because when they're... And I have a conversation coming up with an ND1, because I obviously am not a subject matter expert, so he'll explain it in greater detail. But when they go up on a flight, and if they are in an environment where the pressure changes too rapidly, it will cause a similar medical condition that divers go through when they ascend too quickly. I don't want to go into detail and catch myself saying something completely false, but because I really don't know in-depth information, but basically the same symptoms can happen when the air pressure changes too rapidly and it causes extreme pain. I will say this, though. I remember this little bit from ND1. He said that this technology that they use, while it's modern and definitely effective, I mean, modern as in the best treatment out there that we have in 2021, the idea for this treatment actually came from the late 1800s.
The late 1800s?
Yes. The same basic principles, because they found that while assembling a bridge, workers would come back to the surface and be in extreme pain. Their joints would be aching.
A bridge?
Yes, a bridge. So they
Underwater, like,
exactly.
Okay.
They'd go down in a capsule and do some sort of underwater construction work. They would ascend and be in a lot of pain. They basically, I believe it was the bends, or it could be one of them.
I think it's the bends. That's
right.
I don't know exactly what it is.
And I'm trying not to be too technical, because I'll prove my ignorance once again. But these workers back in the 1800s would have extreme pain. They would ascend and be aching, and someone eventually realized it's because of the pressure changes. So that was the reason for decompression chambers being invented. And when a pilot goes through this, they could spend up to 7 hours in this cylindrical.
Seven
hours in the cylindrical. It's very tight. I had to ask about 3 times if people that were claustrophobic ever go into there, and then the Navy divers eventually said, hey dummy, claustrophobic people don't become pilots. So, you know, that finally got through my head. I'll shine a little bit more light on it on my experience after we hear from my conversation with ND1 Hayden, the Navy diver who is trained to operate the decompression chamber.
The recompression chamber, or hyperbaric chamber, is a medical device used to treat a couple of diving-related disorders, specifically arterial gas embolism and decompression sickness. On board, we use it to treat pilots, specifically of the F-18s, for decompression sickness when they lose cabin pressure. It induces decompression sickness the same way that diving incorrectly will do.
What happens to a pilot, if you can just go into layman's terms, I suppose, for those of us that will never experience what you've experienced, nor what a pilot goes through. What happens to a pilot when cabin pressure is, goes wrong and they need your treatment?
Sure. So when you're breathing normal air, your body contains a lot of dissolved gas in its bloodstream. So specifically when you're breathing air, you're going to be containing your inert gas, which is nitrogen, and oxygen. Your body can metabolize the oxygen, but the nitrogen just stays in solution in your tissues. When you lose pressure, either when you're diving and you go from, say, 30 or 60 feet up to the surface, or when you're in an airplane and you go from a pressurized cabin, which is pressurized to about 8,000 feet to 40,000 feet where they're operating, that the ambient pressure will drop, and that gas will come out of solution in the form of bubbles. And those bubbles will get in your joints. In more severe cases, it can get in your spine and interrupt your nervous system. And going into the recompression chamber can put those bubbles back into solution and give your body time to reabsorb that gas.
So now you can see that was ND1 Hayden again from CTF 70, who is in charge of the decompression chamber on the ship. Now you can see MC2 Jarmolowski why I didn't want to go in depth trying to explain what this thing is for, because he used a lot of technical language that was accurate. But when you see these divers turning knobs and watching gauges as someone's being treated, because they did an example, no one was being treated, but they were able to go do a run through for me. It's like a scientist. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's a whole side of the job that I never even thought existed for the divers.
So that's on board. You didn't know it, maybe you did, but treating pilots with a piece of equipment that you would assume is for divers happens when needed, and the flight surgeon, there's even a little segment on the cylindrical sort of tube, the white, I'm not going to call it casket, but it's so tight, it's I'm sure they're fine.
Is there a window?
There's a window, yes. So the Navy diver will look in, and there's a little comm system so he can press a button and speak with the pilot being treated. They'll give a thumbs up, thumbs down. Hey, is the pressure good? They're all very professional. They go through lots of training, you can tell, to make sure that it's done well. Yeah. And the flight surgeon can actually go into the end of the tube. There's a little capsule for him. That's the word I was looking for, capsule.
Oh, okay.
And he can tend to the patient as needed and then close the hatch and have the air pressure go back to normal so the flight surgeon can get out when he needs to. It's pretty impressive. And that's on board right now.
Thank you for listening. I'm MC2 Jarmolowski, and I'll be the new host of the Hellcast. MC2 Warren has transferred, and so I will be taking the reins of the podcast, hopefully driving it into interesting new directions, as well as being able to learn a lot and talk to different interesting people around the ship. Until next time, this is the Hellcast.